This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rasslan, today we have BFM's very own Uma Pagan Umke Pagan.
Hello, Cam.
And we have the return of writer, comedian, blogger, Charmaine Othman.
Yay!
Great to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
And our three topics this week are: topic number one is the function of women in movies. Topic number two is Christian apologetics. And finally, topic number three is the arts in Malaysia Baru.
Mm-hmm.
If Malaysia Baru is such a thing.
It is.
Okay. So, the function of women in movies. I was watching an old movie the other day. It was made in 1952, and it's set in 1952. It's a British film, directed by the great David Lean, my favourite film director, and it's called The Sound Barrier. And it was starring his then-wife, Anne Todd, who was quite a big deal in British movies in those days. And so she could demand pretty much whatever she wanted in terms of the roles that she played. She wasn't a passive, a low-build female actress. She was a big deal. So I was watching it, and several things struck me. One was really old-fashioned things, like, for instance, a newly married couple, and they're already sleeping in separate beds. It's such an old 1950s thing. I never understood that. But the other thing was that, so it's about breaking the sound barrier, and her husband's a test pilot, and her father's the boss of the company that's building the jet engines. And her function seemed to be not much more than a sort of a Luddite, a kind of a progress naysayer. She's saying to her husband, you know, don't do it, Johnny, it's too dangerous, think of the children. And she's saying to her father, who's just like getting through test pilots like nothing, you know, progress, but at what cost, father? And I couldn't help think of that scene in Star Wars, that rather notorious scene in Star Wars, where Princess Leia's home planet has just been blown up. But there she is consoling Luke, who's just lost Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Right.
Right. And, you know, the female function seems to be this, I don't know, stand in for humanity.
Yeah.
But in its weakest sense.
Correct.
But they're always seen like saying things, not really doing things.
The maternal surrogate, right?
Yeah. But also you can maybe look at it like, I mean, who were the writers of these films? They must have been male writers.
Oh, entirely, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess maybe that's how most men like see women, as just like this, like you say, like, you know, the maternal surrogate, yeah.
Yeah, but then you jump forward to a movie which I've never liked. I think you like it, Uma. The Right Stuff.
I love that movie.
Okay.
Tom Wolfe wrote the book and the screenplay. I think he co-wrote the screenplay along with William Goldman, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. So the movie's from the 90s.
Yes.
And it's about the American space race, but it starts off with the breaking of the sound barrier.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And again, in that one, women are tremendously background.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you go to, say, Apollo 13, where it's a movie about the space race again.
Yeah.
And the women are at home, just being worried.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you come to Hidden Figures.
Correct.
Where the women are not.
Well, see, and and therein lies the problem, right? So the argument of, oh, well, you know, it was a male-dominated time, so the stories are primarily about men. Actually, no. It's just that very few people actually sat down with the women to find out what was going on. Everyone just focused on
the
male history, right? Yeah.
No, but there is... there is historical truth in the fact that women were not included. And I think in the case of Hidden Figures, the characters there were more black
than
women.
Women. Yeah, exactly.
If you know what I mean.
No. I mean, I'm not saying that the women were included in, say, the actions of what happened in NASA for Apollo 13. But what I mean is that no one actually bothered asking them their story.
What would a woman do, like, in this film? Like, what would she be doing, right? Like,
correct.
Yeah. So what could she be doing?
What could a female character be doing? But then, you know, it's a reflection of society. And then at that time, you know, I guess there were not many women in, I wouldn't say dangerous, but very complicated, like, professions. So maybe it was that, you know, writers, you know, they write what they know and they don't see women. And I mean, now that you're mentioning it, and now we're having this whole like 30% thing, and there's so much argument going on about why do we need 30%, and people don't realize we need 30%, and it will in the end, you know, affect like so many things, like even our arts. Yeah, the stories we tell.
But also in the stories we tell, I mean, let's say a really simple story like The Right Stuff, which is just human beings earthbound and then they progress to space.
Yeah.
So on that journey, you could also imagine that male characters can evolve in some way.
Mm-hmm.
The female characters never evolve because they are homebound, mothering at the beginning and the same at the end. Is that construct in itself a male-driven idea of what story is. I mean, you know, you're saying 30% or less, you know, let's find out what women did, etc. Are we already trying to shoehorn female stories into a story arc that's already very male-driven?
I don't think we're trying to shoehorn it in. I think it's a vacuum that needs to be filled. So if you look at Apollo 13, I think it's Rita Wilson's character, if I'm not mistaken. Is it Rita Wilson?
Yes,
I can't remember who the actress was.
Wife,
was. Who was at home looking after the family while the husband was in one of the most dangerous situations imaginable, right? But of course, we got that brief glimpse.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much more to that story, and that story is interesting as well because she was a picture of calm in the absolute worst possible situation. So how do you tell that story, and why is that story not important? Because obviously, it is so crucial in the story arc of NASA that these women played that part for these men to go off and do dangerous things. We think the dangerous thing is the be-all and end-all,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but it's not. People don't look at like the women who like say goodbye to their husbands, and who knows, they might have to look after the family by themselves.
Mm.
But you know, you ask, what is the function of women in films, right?
Mm.
What is the function of men in films?
I find that men are given many different functions, though, yes, their story arc is often, you know, they start off as essentially a boy-like character, mm-hmm. and then they become adult, whatever that might mean, and we see that journey.
Yeah.
And women, I think, are often used as simply tools to help them in their progress.
Yeah, I think we still get it till today.
Still get it.
Like Baby Driver was like, ugh.
But if let's say I've just described the male arc correctly, Charmaine, what would be a convincing female arc?
A convincing female arc? Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's look at Wonder Woman.
Was that a satisfying female arc for you?
A female or male arc?
Female.
Female arc.
Well, what has been a convincing, satisfying female arc?
Yeah, is there anything that you've seen recently that made you go,
go girl?
Go girl. I'm trying to think.
Well, Hidden Figures, did you enjoy that?
Hidden Figures, yeah. Because Wonder Woman was kind of like, I think what was with Wonder Woman and what's the name of the island where all of them are there?
Oh, Themyscira.
Yes. You know, I like that. I like that you didn't see a lot of men, and I'm looking forward to it. Ocean's Eight.
With
the all-female cast.
Yeah.
So I think maybe now is the period where we're trying to figure out what is the function of women in cinema and what kind of discourse that it creates, yeah.
You know, Wonder Woman's a very interesting superhero story also because, it was envisioned, it was directed by a woman as well.
Yeah.
So you've got the female POV
behind
the camera, which is as important as what happens in front of the camera. But also, if you look at all of her action sequences in the movie, they all start from a defensive posture as well. She's protecting something.
Mm.
And that's a very different twist on the superhero arc well.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, it may fall into an old trope of the female as maternal and protector, but when employed in a superhero function, I think it becomes quite a powerful tool. Like, you know, you've seen it, right, Cam? When she steps out into the trenches in World War One, right? It's not an attacking posture as well. Everyone else is dying and at a loss. And she walks in and she takes the bullet. She's defending people from the attack, which is quite interesting.
Protector. Okay, we'll move on. I just quickly say, though, my convincing female arc is The Parent Trap. I love that movie. and so, Uma, topic number two, Christian apologetics.
Yeah, we're jumping ahead now to something completely different. But but it's not completely different because I'm going to tie it back into Malaysia Baru, like what Charmaine is going to do with the arts later.
Yes.
But I was thinking about how we approach this new euphoria that we are facing and experiencing, and all of us are, right? We're writing about it, we're tweeting about it, we're talking about it, we have a new spring in our step. And I was looking at Christian apologetics as a kind of study. So Christian apologetics, if you don't know, was a branch of study in which it presents Christianity with historical, reasoned, evidential basis. You know, it was trying to add that to religion so it would use logic to explain, logic and science, you know, and it will defend it that way against objections. Okay?
Yeah.
And for me, it feels like for the longest time, we have been so critical of government and the powers that be. And now we're in a situation where we feel that things have changed. But how does that affect our criticality? And that's the thing that I'm struggling with on a day-to-day basis, because I don't want to be euphoric. I don't want to be too happy. And yet I don't want to slip into cynicism.
I think every Malaysian is suffering from slight PTSD.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Because, like, well, I'm turning 35 and you've been raised 35 years in that, people are calling it a regime. And then suddenly that's, you know, gone. And then you're like, okay. And suddenly you feel like how you look at things have to change now.
Also, when someone announces something, like from the powers that be, you're thinking, wait, am I supposed to agree with this? I don't understand.
Yeah, yeah. Can I question this? Can I, yeah.
So can I just backtrack a little bit? So what's the Christian apologist who's got?
Okay, so the reason that I was trying to find a way to actually a kind of pedagogy for how do I approach this. So I was reading a lot of, and also by the name of G.K. Chesterton, one of my favorite authors, and he was a Christian apologist, and he was a brilliant author. He wrote a lot of fiction, but he also wrote theological pieces defending Christianity, right? Yeah.
But he's most famous for Father Brown Mysteries.
He's most famous for Father Brown Mysteries, correct. Yeah. But I'm going to read you something, and it's one of my favorite passages from him, because I think that for me helped cement how I feel I should approach this Malaysia Baru with a sense of optimism as opposed to cynicism, right? And I think it's how we all approach religion as well. So hear me out, right? I won't read the whole thing, but I'll read some of the best bits. So he says, let us suppose we are confronted with a desperate thing, say Pimlico. If we think what is really best for Pimlico, we shall find the thread of thought leads to the throne of the mystic and the arbitrary. It's not enough for a man to disprove of Pimlico. In that case, he will merely cut his throat or move to Chelsea. Nor certainly is it enough for a man to approve of Pimlico, for then it'll remain Pimlico, which would be awful. And that is a problem we all have with Malaysia. Now, the only way out of it seems to be for somebody to love Pimlico, to love it with a transcendental tie and without any earthly reason. If there arose a man who loved Pimlico, then Pimlico would rise into ivory towers and golden pinnacles. If men loved Pimlico as mothers love children, arbitrarily, because it is theirs, Pimlico in a year or two might be fairer than Florence. Some readers will say this is mere fantasy. I answer that it is the actual history of mankind, that this, as a fact, is how cities did grow great. Go back to the darkest roots of civilizations and you will find them knotted round some sacred stone or encircling some sacred well. People first paid honor to a spot and afterwards gained glory for it. Men did not love Rome because she was great. She was great because they had loved her.
Wow.
It is beautifully, I mean, his words are magnificent. And I keep thinking about what we have to do about Malaysia, how we question our own sense of place and patriotism, and whether you are Melayu, China, India, Orang Asal, whatever, and your place in this thing. And here's the thing. I don't have questions about identity. I'm not worried about my identity politics. Who am I as an Indian in Malaysia? La, 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 all that stuff. No. I'm thinking about who we are as Malaysians, and I think that has drastically changed since May 9th. And I swear to God, when I go on air every day, I struggle about talking about these issues. Because I honestly don't know what makes me sound like a goon, you know, in the face of this new reality.
Yeah.
How are you coping with this, Charmaine?
No, like someone,
I mean, I read your Facebook post and you seem as confused as the rest of us.
A bit confused, but I'm kind of like taking it with like a lot of optimism. And I tweeted this, Tan Keng Hua, Singaporean actress, and she put it on Instagram, like, headlines, we won. And a Singaporean commented saying how Malaysians have a culture of heart, which is very, it's the first time I'm hearing it. You know, we have such a strong culture of heart. We're very passionate because they were very impressed when, well, we took it to the streets in 98, Reformasi, and how, you know. So, like, I think generally Malaysians, like you say, you know, they do love the country. And I guess sometimes you second guess your love, right?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking that we're in a moment of change, which we're going to probably talk about much more, actually, in Charmaine's part. Yeah, I found myself this morning actually going back, looking at some of the things I'd written in the past. Now, I found the piece that was the most kind of loving about Malaysia, and I was like, I'm going to post this. But I couldn't work out how to do PDFs on stuff, so I gave up.
We'll help you.
But I'm not entirely sure I'm convinced by G.K. Chesterton's
argument.
Thing,
no?
Argument.
No, really?
What?
Well, one, because I've been to Pimlico.
Okay.
I'm just taking his word for it that it's awful.
And but also, slightly different thing. This conversation we're having right now is KL, it's English language, etc. So there's a whole other bunch of conversations happening somewhere else. And I would like to know what those conversations are, and I have no idea what they are, and I don't even know how to begin to access them. So I'm worrying that we are getting too obsessed by our own conversations.
But also, I think we haven't even come to terms with our own conversations.
Yeah. My answer is, I don't know. But it's good. It's a good I don't know.
Approach it with hope and love is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's a good place to finish for this.
until, you know, 6 months down the line, 1 year down the line, we just become cynical and jaded like before.
Yeah.
You know, right now we're all smiles and happy.
All right. Well, in a moment, though, we're going to see if we can think of ways to how we actually do something about this when we come to the arts in the New Malaysia here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. Hello, and we're back with me, Kam Raslan, Umapagan Amkepakan, and Charmaine Othman. So now, Charmaine, the arts. In Malaysia Baru.
Yeah, what's going to happen? I think everyone is sort of like antsy right now, but we all know that it's not going to be the government's priority. So we're giving them 6 months. Well, at least me and, you know, the practitioners who are close to me. But I think all of us are very excited. I think the thing we're most excited about is media freedom. And the stories that we can tell, hopefully we can tell like better stories, and we can, you know, we no longer have to like depend on doing a TV version of a Malay novel about, you know, pedophilia or something. So yeah, but I think what needs to happen is, I don't know, I think for me, I would like to see sort of like an arts council, which also I think oversees TV as well. And I think the step forward is to sort of have these guidelines or regulations. Okay, RTM has them, like, but these are just like censorship guidelines.
Right.
But I think there should be guidelines like, it's like school, like universities. Your TV show has to have at least like, you know, 20% Chinese characters, Chinese and Indian characters. Because right now, what's dominating the TV screens are just the Malays. And you're already like losing like a segment of like, you know, viewers.
So and stories.
And stories, yeah. And with the arts, I think with the arts, like multiculturalism is already like there in the arts, in like theatre and dance and music. I think what they need now is, you know, funding and also like a proper like a syllabus in our education system, because that's what we need. Like the arts needs audiences, and there are not enough audiences. So what are your dreams for the arts and TV and film? Yeah.
Well, first of all, I think a lot of what you just said is so 2017.
Oh, yeah? What's 2018 then, Kev?
Well, we've been so ingrained in our minds, this notion of guidelines and practices and whatnot. And so we kind of feel like we've got to have guidelines. But actually, we could find ourselves in a situation where there aren't no guidelines. And that's really what we should be aiming at, is no guidelines. Because why try to, you know, bracket us?
I feel like we need guidelines maybe for now. Because if not, like, people are just, like, not going to include Chinese and Indian characters. I was working with Dr. Jason. We worked together on a series and we applied for the FINAS grant. All the main characters were Chinese, Indian, and there was one Malay character. And we didn't include the Malay character in our pitch. And, you know, we go into FINAS and, like, you know, the officer is like, okay, yeah, good, good, good. But, you know, where is the Malay character? And I was this close to saying, on every other show on TV.
Yeah, it's the first question.
So I feel like, I know what you mean. Like, it shouldn't be a guideline. But I feel like that it's the step that we need to take for more, like, inclusivity, yeah.
All right, so maybe we just don't call it guidelines. Maybe because a good arts council, like you said, all of the councils at the moment or the institutions that are set up at the moment are to regulate and to censor, right? Whether it's the MCMC or whether it's LPF or whatever, right? But a good council, I believe, the role is to develop.
Yes.
Facilitate.
So facilitate, exactly. Facilitate and develop, right? And maybe you don't need the kind of set-in-stone regulations and guidelines, but you need this council with a mix of experts and, you know, everyday consumers as well to actually advise. And I think that's what's actually lacking, in the sense that, yes, I know studios and all these people are going to do what is commercially viable, but we have the added thing on top of trying to make something commercially viable, exactly what you pointed out, Charmaine, with this racial tinge on everything, this protectionist mentality, right? That somehow if you have one show without a Malay character, people will forget that Malay people exist.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know, and that's what's got to change. That honestly shouldn't have been the first question the guy asked you.
Yeah.
He should have been like, you know, oh, this is funny, or how do we make it funnier?
Funny,
or, you know, like, talk about the content as opposed to...
When Ola Bola musical was on, my friend took her aunties to go watch it. And her aunties love watching Malay dramas on TV. And the auntie walked out of Istana Budaya. Where did they find these Chinese and Indian actors who can dance and sing? Are there like Chinese?
Where are they?
Like, and the auntie was like, I don't see them on TV. And that was like an indication like, we need more like Chinese and Indian.
Should just say that Charmaine wrote
the book, not the play,
the musical.
Yeah. So I think So I know it's, we maybe don't need like a hard guideline, but like a council that oversees that has to ensure that there's inclusivity and even things like portrayal of stronger female characters. Like, female characters out there are currently so weak.
Facilitating the male character.
Almost every major Malay movie, right?
It's
so funny you say facilitating the male character, and all I think of is Ting, Wan Azizah and Anwar. It's so funny, yeah. But you know, now that, you know, we have a female deputy prime minister, we cannot have any more like weak female characters. And I think the other thing, the arts are looking forward, like an arts council to look after the welfare of artists.
Yes, because God knows the individual organizations right now look after the welfare of themselves.
Yes, and a lot of them sort of use it to sort of like advance their political agenda. So I think all the artists are looking forward to, like, you know, the council.
Like a union or something,
like, a union to protect us, because like the arts, the entertainment industry have really been like sidelined for so many years.
No, I don't know. There's so many rich people in theatre and
but
stuff.
But then they're rich by not doing art. They're rich by like selling headscarves and supplements, you know? Yeah.
Actually, last week on this show, Bernice Chorley was here and her topic was about the arts councils. You know, Malaysia must have an arts council. Yeah. One thing she pointed out straight away is, in the case of the British one, it is funded by the National Lottery.
The National Lottery being
a numbers game.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's gambling.
Yeah.
But it makes an awful lot of money.
Money, yeah.
I mean, an arts council really is a place that funds arts.
Yeah.
That's what his role is seen as in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily as a moral guardian or anything like that. So it, you know, perhaps it's a case of money. Money needs to... I don't know if a national lottery would work. I don't think it can work here.
Can't work here because of the idea of a lottery and gambling and all of that stuff. Because by right, you know, it excludes such a big part of the population because your people are not allowed to play the lottery.
Yeah, so...
That's right. So, like, we have, like, the, you know, associations, right? The Cinemans and the PPFM and the MDAM. And then...
Banyak association.
Yeah, a lot of associations. And then, like, we have LPF and censorship. And then we have, like, Cendana and all these, you know, I would say...
Finas,
there's so many. And I think all of them just need to go under one, like, big arts council. And they have sort of, like, different branches, That's the way forward.
Because, and also, because none of them talk, right?
None of them talk to each other. They're always fighting. Because I watch Gobindio Singh's interview on RTM, and, you know, he said, you know, media shapes how the public thinks. I mean, people always sideline the arts, but whenever an artist does something, you know, controversial, they put us in jail. So don't say the arts is not important. The arts is important. If it's not important, you wouldn't be putting us in jails. Well, before this, lah.
Yeah. You go, girl.
Correct.
I'm doing the finger thing. You taught me.
I don't know. For me, I mean, just looking at film and all of the things that need to be fixed, I honestly would get rid of Wajib Tayang so quickly.
Yes, definitely.
For those of you who don't know, Wajib Tayang is essentially a program under FINAS that ensures that all Malaysian movies will get a certain period in cinema. Cinemas hate it because, you know, it uses up a screen for something they know won't sell. And I just dislike it because there are a lot of filmmakers who abuse that to get a movie into cinema, who abuse the funding they get for that movie and don't think about the commercial prospects at all.
Yeah.
Well, I think that film here could have a lift if they do follow the British model, where there's BBC films and there's Channel 4 films.
Correct.
Yeah. So RTM, or TV3 for that matter, could be involved in the making of films. But what it would mean, and I think we also have to accept, is actually the market here is terribly small.
Yes.
I mean, the population of Malaysia is, what, 30 million? But even then, I mean, you have to break it down to maximum, say, 15 million potential movie-going population. So we have to accept that there must be fewer films.
Yes.
Of higher quality.
Of higher quality, correct.
That's
exactly
how it used to be in the
90s. That's how it used to be.
Oh my God, we're going back to the 90s.
Yeah. Sekarang,
you know, 90s.
3 years ago, there were 80 films. That was a bad idea. Then last year, there were 40 films. Still a bad idea. This year, I think there will be fewer films because last year, so few of them made any money.
But,
you know, that 15 million, I don't know what the number of the movie-going population in Malaysia is, but that small movie-going population, in the period of 2 weeks, allowed Avengers Infinity War to make 65 million ringgit at the box office.
Wow, 2 weeks.
65, yeah. That's insane. That means there is spend.
People want to see movies. Yeah.
Yes, and I know, we cannot make a $300 million movie.
Obviously.
That's not the point.
Yeah.
But we can make good movies. We've got good movies.
I mean, Ola Bola is, I think, a good example.
Yeah.
I mean,
one of the highest grossing movies of all time in Malaysia.
Ola Bola,
they made good money. And that was not even aimed at the traditional Malay movie market.
Exactly,
Well, to be fair, the only way a Malaysian movie makes 17, 18, 20 million is if Chinese, Indians, Malays, Samoa go and watch it.
Exactly.
It has to rest. So that's why The Journey, you know, when I went to see The Journey in cinemas, it was multicolored. When I went to see that new Rajinikanth movie, there were more Malays than Indians in the cinema, right? You know, but yet, when you speak to studio heads and all of that stuff, there is still a very old-fashioned thinking with, oh, no, this is not what the audience wants.
Absolutely. Well, must move on, but briefly, though, are we optimistic about the arts and culture?
At this point, I think we're all just waiting to see what happens. There hasn't been any sort of like concrete discussions yet. I think YB Fahmi Fazil met with some of the artists, Nick Nazmi as well.
Sekarang ada actor dekat Parlimen.
We have an actor in Parlimen.
Like an actual actor. We had lots of actors before. But, you know.
It's like actual actor, YB. Yeah. See, exactly. The arts is important. The arts, you know, gave us Fahmi Fazil.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. So, Arts Council, let's make it happen. So, we move on, though, to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something we think might be of interest. I'm going first, aren't I? My recommendation is to follow on, actually, from what we were talking about just now, Charmaine, is Rich People, Go and Fund the Arts. If you're out there and you got money, it's time for you to go and fund the arts. Because not so very long ago, people who had it within their power to go and fund theatre, arts, you know, website, whatever, were not doing so because they were afraid of their government and they were afraid of the backlash. I think we can safely say that fear should be gone now.
Yes.
And you don't need to be afraid of your government now. And so go fund the arts. There are so many different places that you can go to and you can have your name emblazoned as a sponsor or not, if that's what you want. But one thing that has been really missing for too long is individual donations, sponsorship. And I would say, we've been talking about the government's role. Yes, it's very important, of course, but the arts in Europe, etc., really require funding from companies and from individuals.
From the 1200s, that's how it's worked.
In London, like Big Tree, the billboard company, free, I think, for like...
Oh, really?
Theatre shows or like... 10%, like they pay like a super cheap price, sort of like their community service,
Because back in the Renaissance times, I think I may have mentioned this before, you know, people had never heard of Leonardo da Vinci and stuff. They were talking about the Medicis, the ones who actually bought the art.
Commissioned it.
And the guy who painted it, well, they didn't care.
I mean, look at Wolf of Wall Street. I mean, it's a good example of, you know...
exactly, rich people
funding,
buying stuff.
You know?
How many cars you need, buy a painting.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so that's my recommendation. It's time. So, Uma, what's yours?
Okay, so I'm going to recommend a task, an activity for people to do. And it's very easy for you to do now. Okay, so I was watching a Netflix series called Bobby Kennedy for President, and it's a four-part documentary series about Bobby Kennedy and his kind of political rise, right? But my takeaway from the series, or what really made me sad watching the series, was the sheer amount of archival footage, audio and video that they had. Yeah. You know, there are some talking heads in this documentary series, but most of it is black and white and recolored footage and just audio of Bobby Kennedy, like, sitting around a table talking to people. I'm like, where did you find this, right? And I think about how we have none of it. We have nothing, right? And I want people, you all have recording devices on your smartphones, right? If you're listening to this show, if you're listening to a podcast, it means you have a smartphone, which means everyone, Android, iOS, has audio recorder. Find it. Go and talk to your grandmother. Go and talk to your grandfather. Just record that. Once they're gone, once they're dead, you will never have their voice and you will never have their stories ever again, right? Even your parents. Because, sure, you see your parents every day. Maybe you say, I love you. You talk to them and blah, blah, blah. But when was the last time you sat down and went, hey, you know, Uncle so-and-so, you know, he had an interesting story. Tell me about that. Get their voice on tape. Because I now regret a lot of my family members who have passed on and I don't have their voice anywhere.
Now that you mentioned it,
right?
Yeah, actually, like, you forget how...
I forget.
How they sounded like, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have these old cassette tapes in my house because, you know, my family used to have consult an astrologer.
Yeah.
And sometimes my grandma will record what the astrologer has to say and then listen to it later, you know? And so I have my grandmother's voice on some of those tapes.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, I've forgotten what my grandma sounds like.
Yeah.
And it's a scary thing.
Yeah.
You think, I can picture her... But you forget the sound of her voice. And that's weird.
Yeah. I know what you're saying, and I agree with you entirely, but I think you and I might be slightly different people because you're very enthusiastic and optimistic about this.
But
I find it a slightly morbid thing to
do. No, it's a very morbid thing, right?
And it puts remember me you when you die.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you mind if I record you?
don't go into that. Like, that's not your opening line.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I mean, I want to know these stories and I want to hear these stories. And yes, you're right. It is incredibly morbid.
But they have Insta stories now. And it's all in your archive. Do you know that you have an archive on your Instagram?
I know.
Yeah.
But so, those are
I would say
30 seconds at a time, Shemaine.
Well, I think also to follow up on what you're saying, though, is actually format is important because you're talking about cassette tapes and everything.
Yeah, how many people can play a cassette?
Yeah,
right?
So you have to choose some kind of format that has some lasting power. And I've got so many things on my phone, which, if you know, I lose my phone, I mean, it's all gone. So I've got to find a way to...
I really got to teach you how to back up that thing to the cloud, my friend.
Clouds are things up in the air that rain
from. The rain comes from, yes.
But you know, even then, though, I mean, are we definitely sure that that's going to be an archive that's trustworthy?
We don't know. But for the moment, I think we have to do something. In the sense that even if it's not for public consumption like this documentary series or something like that, even for personal... private consumption. How many of us can... I was just thinking about this the other day. I don't know why. I don't know anyone who's dying, by the way. I'm just saying. I just thought about it. How many of us can name our great-great-grandfathers? Like, I can't. I can go up to my great-grandfather and then I don't know the name of that individual, right? Because I've never asked anyone.
Right.
And when I ask my dad's like, I think I know his name. And, you know, I think I know her name.
I do. Actually, I do know their name.
You do? Okay, that's good. But we don't. And I think...
Great-great-grandmothers, on the other hand, that's harder. Yeah, okay. So go to your parents and say, look... You're going to die soon, but before you do, do you mind if we just...
Let's have a chat and record it.
Excellent. No, it's a worthwhile thing. But I would just say that I have actually done such things in the past.
Right.
And I put it on to, say, CDs, and even the CDs are now...
Now you can't
play CDs. You can't see them,
And I had it on tape. And that, so
but that's
I'm
the constant process, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's the same with film, right? From reels to film to digital, and then what digital format?
Yeah.
I wonder what's going to happen after this.
Yeah.
After digital,
laser. I don't know.
Yeah, like
something cool.
Wireless.
It's a chip in your brain.
It's a chip in your brain, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so show me.
What's my recommendation?
Yeah.
Well, because it's Puasa, so I've been watching a lot of Netflix. I just started watching, when she's only got one episode, Michelle Wolf's show.
Yes.
Called The Break. It's part like late night show, part SNL, part Ellen because she brings on a guest and it's funny. She makes fun of everyone. She doesn't just make fun of the Trump administration. She makes fun of Democrats. She makes fun of everyone. And if you can get past her very squeaky voice.
She's quite squeaky.
Yeah. It's really, really funny. But yeah, it is a good watch. It's very different from the late night shows. It's very different from
It's very different from all the male late night shows.
It's very different. Even Chelsea Handler had her show on Netflix.
That's right.
Which I quite enjoyed.
I did too.
Because
she's crazy.
She's crazy. And she went in going like, look, I'm an American. I'm stupid. I don't know things. So I'm going to learn it through the show. And that's what she did. So yeah, Michelle Wolf, you know, I mean, we're talking about the function of female in films. Mm. So I guess like it's a very refreshing take on like social and political commentary. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's so smart though.
So Michelle Wolf suddenly burst to fame because of her
White House correspondence dinner, which
was hilarious.
Which is one of the sharpest things I've seen in a while.
Yeah. Yeah. I watched it several times. It was like, whoa, that's so clever. And
it
funny.
Was like, I don't know whether it's because I'm a woman, but when I watched it, like I felt like every joke of hers landed.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, sometimes when I watch the late night, well, you know,
yeah,
you know, some jokes, but I thought her first episode was really solid and really strong. Yeah.
Yeah.
So definitely, yeah.
Are you looking at these, especially the late night and the John Oliver's as a sort of clue as to what we should be thinking of doing?
Yeah.
As entertainers stroke commentators in Malaysia.
But I think like, so Awani is not really doing like using comedy to talk about, you know, politics, but they've already started discussions and that's good. I think that's the way forward. Like the stuff that we produce for TV, you know, has to like encourage more discourse. Yeah. Mm. And I'm hoping like, you know, because I'm about to start like my own all-female, like female-centric comedy platform. So like, I'm hoping like we can, you know, do something like what Michelle Wolf is doing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So Awani should be giving a call to Charmaine Othman,
yes,
should they?
Yeah.
Okay. We know they're listening.
Yeah, yeah. They really should, actually.
Yeah.
Actually. Anyway, so well, that brings us to the end of this week's show. Only remains for me now to thank special honoured guest, Charmaine Othman.
Thank you.
You do so many things. What are you doing now?
Just about to start writing for a TV series with a strong female lead.
Cool.
Yes.
Cool. Like Roseanne.
Yeah. Just like that.
Right, but even better.
Yeah.
Pagan, I'm okay, Pagan.
Did you say Roseanne or Rosma? I missed that. So
thank you. It's again. So nice that we can see all these things
I know.
Now.
Or can we? We're going to find out. Myself, Cam Ruslan. You can get in touch with us actually through Twitter. Pagan, I'm okay, Pagan is at Pagan.
That's right.
And he's like got thousands. Charmaine has a more closed circuit, but
I have my public one, Charmaine Othman. Yeah.
Right, right. And you can learn quite a lot about Charmaine on that one. She tweets a lot. And myself, at Cam Ruslan, because that is your civic duty in Malaysia Baru. So please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.